From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar, and we begin this week discussing the death of Fidel Castro this past weekend with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
Tony, the death of Fidel Castro. I mean, I guess it was inevitable, but it's certainly a shock still.
Yeah, and it left people speechless here. And Rosario Murillo, when she was she did a special. She always on weekdays, Rosario Murillo does a daily message to people in Nicaragua, updating everybody on the latest activities and any relevant stuff that's happening in the country. And so on yesterday, Saturday, she did a special broadcast. She doesn't normally do one on a Saturday, but and she during that she was talking to people about how she and Danielle reacted to the news of Fidel's death, and she said that it just left them speechless. And when she told Danielle late on Saturday night that Fidel had died, he couldn't take it in. He thought he didn't understand what she was saying, because it's just so. And I think that gives you an idea of just how incomprehensible it is, or it was in the moment.
Yeah,
I have a friend trying to take in that news.
I have a friend on Facebook who posted that the CIA's last assassination attempt, which was a clever plan to wait until Fidel died of old age, succeeded.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. And those CIA guys, they're real Machiavellian, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. Yep.
But Fidel, he was 90, and you made this point in what you were saying the interview you did with RT, and he's been, and it was 60 years ago that he died on the 60th anniversary of the day that he and Che Guevara and the other comrades who set out on that incredible expedition, the day that they left Mexico as a tiny guerrilla group determined, and it was completely quixotic at the time.
Yep.
They set out from Mexico to 60 years ago, landed on in Cuba clandestinely with a tiny set of equipment and arms, and 3 years later,
right? 2 years later, because it was January 1st, 1959, so it was really December 31st, 58. Yeah, like a month and a few days. Yeah.
Yeah. So in just 2 years, that tiny group of guerrilla fighters defeated one of the United States gangster bastions in Latin America. And it was just an incredible achievement. And then everything flowed from that. Everything, the following, 50 years?
Yep.
60 years? And the following 60 years have flowed from that. And as you pointed out on to the interviewer on RT, and Fidel Castro is essentially a liberator of two continents, Africa and Latin America, because it was his inspiration and the inspiration of the Cuban Revolution, the inspiration of Fidel and his comrades, Che Guevara, Camilo Cienfuegos, and so many others. These incredible Cuban revolutionaries that transformed Latin America. They made it possible for people like Salvador Allende to come to power in Chile, and then the empire had to react to that.
Right.
And the empire spent the last 60 years reacting to the Cuban Revolution.
Yep, in Grenada, in Nicaragua, in Jamaica, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Chile, in all over the place.
Yeah, as you so rightly pointed out, Fidel's contribution to the liberation of Southern Africa was absolutely key, along with that of Muammar al-Gaddafi and the Libyan Revolution.
Yep. Yeah, I remember, in fact, I played it yesterday, but I every year I run this on the anniversary. Ted Koppel hosted a town hall meeting in Harlem back in, I think, 1992, something like that, 1990, for Nelson Mandela when he made his first trip to the U.S. And some wise guy in the audience, a Democratic operative, Democratic Party operative type, said to Mandela, well, you know, you singing these songs about democracy and equality and all that, but you hang out with people like Muammar Gaddafi, Fidel Castro, and Yasser Arafat. How do you explain that to us? And he said, basically, because while we're fighting apartheid, they were putting resources to us while we're waiting for you to even make a public statement. That might be why.
Right. Right. Good for Mandela.
Yeah, yeah. He did a good job with that.
So yeah, here in Nicaragua, and yesterday was a big event in the Plaza de la Revolución, and Daniel spoke to thousands of young people in the Plaza de la Revolución about what Fidel Castro meant for the region and Nicaragua, and people say, oh, well, look at all these people like Fidel, like Daniel, and others, and they're so old, what relevance do they have now? And their relevance is a tremendously important moral educators for new generations coming along to take up where they and their comrades left off. And it was like, it was really poignant yesterday, Daniel giving essentially a history lesson to these thousands and thousands of young people in Managua's Plaza de la Revolución, and in doing so, he implicitly was explaining why the Cuban Revolution and why the Nicaraguan Revolution and why the revolutionary processes in Latin America continue to be relevant today, not just for Latin America but for the whole world. And when you look back, people referred to Fidel Castro as the last of the great personalities of the 20th century, and when people put him in that context, they're putting him in the context of Mao Zedong, of the great revolutionary leaders of the communist revolutions of the last century, Ho Chi Minh and Muammar al-Gaddafi. And all these tremendous personalities that challenged the dominance of Western imperialism around the world, and so when Daniel was speaking yesterday, he was speaking in a context where Western imperialism, although it's kind of still giving the last kicks of a dying person, and is finished, and it seems to me that. And I wrote briefly about this in an article about the APEC summit that was held the previous weekend.
Right.
At that APEC summit, you had President Xi Jinping, President Vladimir Putin, and President Barack Obama, and a group of leaders from the Southeast Asian countries, Korea, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and the four Latin American countries that are members of the Pacific Alliance. That's Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and Chile. But what that meeting symbolized was, and there was Barack Obama, President Obama, trying to rescue what's left of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and trying to convince an extremely skeptical audience of world leaders that the Trans-Pacific Partnership is still relevant. And whereas President Xi Jinping and President Vladimir Putin were offering the assembled world leaders from Southeast Asia, East Asia, and the Pacific countries of South America and Mexico, they were offering them a vision of integration into the massive development of Eurasia. Yeah. And I think Pepe Escobar has written a lot about this, and other people as well. Yeah. But and essentially, the U.S. has nothing to offer those countries. And the U.S. economy is completely stagnant, if not in recession. And whereas, for all the difficulties that China is having adjusting to the legacy of the 2007-2008 crisis, it still remains an extremely vibrant, dynamic economy. And the same is true of Russia. Russia is remaking its economy in the Eurasian context, and strengthening its economy. The counterproductive sanctions imposed by the United States and its European Union allies have actually meant a resurgence of Russian economic independence, and that is what Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin brought to the APEC summit. Now, the APEC summit is a kind of neoliberal love fest,
right?
And so there's nothing revolutionary in economic and political terms about the content of that summit. But what was revolutionary is that it's unquestionable now that we're in a multipolar world.
That's right.
And Fidel Castro was one of the key people that made that happen.
Yeah, that was one of the points that I wanted to make in those interviews, was that the example that Castro and Cuba, because it was, you know, a largely united effort across the population, gave of, here's only a few million people on a little island 90 miles from the United States that can say no for 58 years and survive and grow.
Right. Yeah, and grow, and by the force of it, the sheer moral force of its example. And I think that Fidel Castro's contribution has essentially been a tremendous moral example inspired people to say, well, if they can do it, well, we can too. And you can see that. And look at Brazil, for example. Ignacio Lula da Silva is a very good friend of Fidel Castro. And a generation younger, right? And a bit like Daniel Ortega and Ignacio Lula da Silva, similar generation, and then another generation down was Hugo Chavez and Nestor and Cristina Kirchner and all those people in Pepe Mujica, right? And so what Fidel's moral example enabled and facilitated was this, what some people refer to, and I think Hugo Chavez used to refer to it, as the second emancipation of Latin America. And Fidel made that happen, and he's made it possible, for example, working together with Hugo Chavez, they made possible this incredible ALBA initiative that is an alliance of countries with progressive governments in Latin America and the Caribbean that is based on solidarity. It's not based on competition, not based on corporate capitalist competition. It's based on the sovereign autonomy of nations and their ability to work together in a spirit of solidarity. And you can see that, for example, in the way that Misión Milagro, this in Cuban and Venezuelan initiative to assist people who have problems with their vision. I mean, just in Nicaragua, 100,000 people have benefited from that program and regained their sight.
Wow.
You know, and that's and over across the region, the number runs into millions.
Yeah, well, across the world. I mean, if you think about how many Cuban doctors have gone out, treated people so they stayed alive and then produced, you know, over their lives, taught doctors. And so now you have doctors in all these places where there were none, and showed people how to build a medical infrastructure. And that reaches, I don't know, more than a billion people, I'm going to guess.
Oh, yeah, sure. And the sheer moral caliber of the Cuban Revolution was demonstrated in the recent outbreak of, when was it, last year or the year before?
Last year, Zika.
Of Ebola.
Ebola in Africa, yep, in West Africa.
In Africa. Yep. And as far as I'm aware, apart from maybe a handful of individuals who took it on themselves as an individual initiative, I'm sure that there were some Western doctors who went and participated. Yes. On their own initiative, but as a government initiative, only the Cuban government sent a significant contingent, hundreds of medical personnel to their, I think they disembarked in Freetown in Sierra Leone, to West Africa to assist the West African countries affected by that outbreak, to deal with and manage and cope with the outbreak of this extremely virulent, frightening disease, lethal disease, the Ebola virus. And Cuba did that, and it was kind of a kind of latter day version of the expeditionary force that Cuba sent in the 1970s to defend Angola against the South African apartheid regime's aggression, backed by, it has to be said, by the United States and its other Western allies. You know, and it was Cuba that defended Angola.
That's right.
And it was Cuba that made it possible finally to defeat, as you pointed out, the apartheid regime.
And folks on the ground in those places know that and remember it. That's the thing. They were asking me, one of them, I don't remember which interview, about Castro's legacy. And I was like, first of all, Castro's legacy is the legacy of the Cuban people, because his primary role was to organize people and to do these things, and the people did it. And as they did it, they left it done in various places around the world. And those people, that's where Castro's legacy lies.
Right. And so, and then when you look at what's happening in the region currently, you have these, you have people talking about a conservative right wing restoration in the region. And I can't help thinking that Fidel's passing also marks the kind of it's the writing on the wall for the right wing in Latin America. And it sounds a paradoxical thing to say.
I agree.
But Fidel's example, that they have been unable to defeat it. You know, and that is going to persist and prevail in Latin America. That example of fundamental solidarity and belief in human potential and focus on the needs of the human person. And Fidel, that's what Fidel Castro stands for in Latin America, despite all the nonsense that you'll read in the Social Democrat and liberal press about the dictator Castro, all that nonsense.
Right.
And no dictator lasts as long as Castro did without the support of his people.
Without the support of an external power like the United States, and rather in the face of overt hostility and repeated attempts at assassination, coups, invasion, etc.
Yeah, and you can see that in the attempts by Mauricio Macri to install his reactionary right-wing regime and the completely failed neoliberal economic agenda. And it's just, it's beyond stupid.
Yep.
And you can see the same thing happening in Brazil. Obviously, we don't know how events are going to pan out. And as I said earlier, the writing is on the wall for those right-wing regimes. And they've essentially had it. it's difficult to see. And the only response the United States is able to offer in terms of policy is chaos.
Right.
And look at Mexico, look at Honduras, look at Guatemala. These are regimes closely allied to the United States. And it'll be interesting to see how the new regime under Donald Trump manages to shuffle and juggle its relationships with Latin America. But it's difficult to see, it's impossible to see any progress being made for Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras, for example, until they adopt the kind of policies for which ultimately Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution are the inspiration.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, look, you're being offered a model of being looted. And if you say yes to that model, you get looted. Now, after you get looted long enough, the people get a little restless. And if you try to loot them more, they get real restless, and then you're gone. And even if you manage to grab power for a minute, again, like they've done in Argentina and Brazil, all they can offer is more looting, and people get that pretty quickly.
Yeah, and so... No, and here in Nicaragua, is going through a period of one of the most successful periods, and in fact, without question, the most successful period in its history. You know, a stability, peace, prosperity, and Nicaragua stands out in the region as a kind of beacon of light and hope compared to what's happening in Honduras and Guatemala.
And that's now before the canal's constructed. Once that happens, assuming that that happens, I mean, the economy doubles right away. Everything you just said, like, moves up in a grand scale.
Yeah, and people have been quite skeptical about, you know, whether or not the canal's going to happen or not. But I think the feeling is that it's definitely going to happen, and that was confirmed by... Wang Jing, the Chinese entrepreneur, the Hong Kong-based entrepreneur, who's at least the public face of the project. I mean, it's pretty clear that the Chinese government supports the project; otherwise, it wouldn't even be on the table.
Right.
But and he wrote to in a Christmas message. Sorry, not a Christmas message. A congratulatory message to Daniel Ortega and Rosario Murillo on their electoral success early in November, and he wrote and confirmed that the canal is definitely going ahead. There was even a report in the Guardian during the week in which they accept. I think their reporter, a guy called Jonathan Watts, and Watts is reporting in that piece that appeared in The Guardian that the canal does seem to be going ahead and people accept that it's going to be going ahead.
Good.
So, you know, and apart from that, but even just say something happened and the canal didn't go ahead for one reason or another. There's so much else happening in the Nicaraguan economy. And with the canal, the Nicaraguan economy is set to grow by about anything between 9% and 11% a year, something like that. Mm-hmm. And but without the canal, it's still going to grow at around 5% or 6% a year.
Which is pretty good.
Which makes the economic. It just shows how stupid and unnecessary and irrelevant the economic policy making is in the United States and Western Europe, and it's absurd that the United States is in a situation where its economy is stagnating or in recession. And look at all the resources that the United States have. It's completely stupid for the U.S. people to be in a position where they're facing economic hardship. I mean, it's just so stupid,
yep,
given all the advantages of the United States, and the same's true in Europe. And that's why people like Trump and Marine Le Pen and Nigel Farage and all these kind of right-wing libertarian-style figures, that's why they're doing so well politically.
Right. Yeah, because they're at least speaking to it, and you know, even if it's rhetorically. But you know, that's the same thing, by the way, with Sanders. I mean, they were calling him a socialist. He's barely a Democrat, but let alone a social Democrat, even in the European sense of the word. But the need is that basically the condition of people is so desperate that they're looking for anything, and it's not being offered by the left.
Yeah, and people ask, you know, what led to the development of progressive regimes in Latin America following the electoral victory of Hugo Chavez back in whenever it was, 1998. And the answer is very clear, that they were offering a policy agenda inspired by Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution, that meets the needs of the human person, that meets ordinary people's needs, their health needs, their education needs, what's happening. One of the interesting things that's happening in Nicaragua is that they're now trying to set up a kind of open university, an online university. You know, there are various questions about, you know, how successful it's likely to be and how coherent it is in terms of the overall needs of the Nicaraguan society and economy. But I mean, that's just another example of how the government intervention and government public sector driven initiatives can completely transform a society in terms of its ability to meet the population's basic needs. Where does that come from? It comes from Fidel Castro and the Cuban Revolution.
Yeah, well, if your power rests on a policy that promises that, it sort of compels you to deliver it. And
right.
And if the institutions are sufficiently democratic, there's accountability, and so there's pressure on the government, which can marshal resources for the benefit of the public better than any other mechanism, for them to do that and do it on behalf of the people to at least satisfy what they want, or else they're gone.
Right. You know, and obviously in ideological terms, and that's a complete vindication of the theoretical arguments from 19th century philosophers like Karl Marx, Engels, and
right.
You know, it's a vindication of the driving principles of the Russian Revolution, mm-hmm. the Chinese Revolution. You know, and whatever one thinks about the subsequent developments in those countries' societies, and the ultimate drive is to meet people's fundamental needs in an equal way and in a truly democratic way.
Yep.
And that's, you know, and that's what Fidel Castro, that's the great lesson of Fidel Castro.
Yep, which, you know, you mentioned earlier, but was picked up by Hugo Chavez and then applied, including the principle of solidarity, which had Venezuela assisting all in places like Nicaragua, for example, with material things like they didn't have doctors, but they did have electrical generators that they gave you to build the electrical infrastructure and things like that. And Cuba sent doctors.
Yeah, and Daniel Ortega recently, another interesting bit of news that takes us back to the whole argument about is there a multipolar world or not. And Nicaragua hosted the signing ceremony for the Central American Free Trade Agreement with South Korea.
Oh.
And there was a very high-level delegation from South Korea and that included high-level parliamentarians and the country's minister for industry, trade and technology. Industry, trade and energy, I think. And they were present for that signing. And at the same time, they took the opportunity to have a ceremony initiating a study center in Central America, which is going to train thousands of young technicians and specialists from all over Central America in how to develop the uses of broadband internet technology for the region's development. Where is that based? It's based in Nicaragua.
Wow.
You know, and so, and that's, why is South Korea investing in Nicaragua? Because Nicaragua is the most stable and relatively politically stable, economically stable, from security point of view, it's the safest country in certainly Central America and probably all of Latin America.
Yeah.
And that's why South Korea is investing in Nicaragua. And where is the United States investment? Where is the United States government investment? You know, that is South Korean investment, the government investing in Nicaragua in an initiative driven by the Nicaraguan government. So that's, and obviously it's in current global economic conditions, it's all closely intertwined with the needs of private business, the private sector. But the the impulse behind the initiative is essentially a governmental public sector one. Yep. And that from South Korea, you know, and that's, if that, to me, that symbolizes in a very succinct way the new reality of a multipolar world that we're in.
Yep, and I agree. On that note, we'll leave it there, Tony. Thank you very much. And you just made a really strong argument for why I need to move to Nicaragua.
Right.
You know, so, all right, take care. Be well, and we will speak with you again soon.
Thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
Me too.
Bye now.
On Friday, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein announced that her campaign sought a recount through official process in Wisconsin and that it intended to do the same in Pennsylvania and Michigan next week. It came with a fundraising call that raised, as of Sunday morning, more than $6 million over the past 4 or 5 days. We spoke about that and what it means with Professor Tony Montero.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure to be with you again.
So the theory of the rolling coup seems to be getting more and more accurate in terms of predicting events coming. Now we have Jill Stein's campaign filing lawsuits in three states that if the outcome is changed, and they're very small margins, all of a sudden, it's not Donald Trump, but Hillary Clinton that wins. And even just the political argument for doing nullification is now in play.
Yeah, and it's so interesting that the neoliberals are organizing and managing this rolling coup. All of those politically correct people, those people for whom identity politics is their calling card. They're the ones who are managing this. And it is a tragic and sad outcome to see Jill Stein as a part of this dirty game of overturning what the electorate decided, playing by what are the rules of this game. And of course, you know, the subtext is a new Cold War, new McCarthyism project that Donald Trump was elected because of Putin, the Russians hacking the computers and the DNC and John Podesta and others, and Julian Assange, who is, of course, in this narrative, an agent of Putin.
Right.
And up till recently, interestingly, Jill Stein was a part of right. the Putin-Assange project of thwarting and undermining American democracy. So, as we've said before, and you and I have discussed this over the months, that the election would not end with the election,
right.
No matter what the outcome was, it would continue. And now we have a full-scale, almost color revolution in play.
Yeah. I mean, the... you know, you think back to analogous... situations, to the extent you can find analogies in history to what's going on right now in the U.S. I mean, there's so many things that are just unprecedented, at least some of them since the Civil War, others even ever, really, in politics in this country. And I don't think anyone's ever faced the media barrage that Trump faced and the supporters of Trump faced over the, you know, up to now, over the last year, year and a half, anywhere in the world.
No, I don't think this has ever happened. And you know, something we have not really talked about a great deal is that this might be, by this I mean the outcome of this election, might be the beginning of a project of taking down the neoliberal globalist throughout the Western world.
Right.
You know, The consequences of that are huge. It's not just the United States, it's the European Union, it's NATO, it's, well, the now almost forgotten TPP.
Right.
You know, and so on. And, you know, with all of the contradictions of the Trump campaign, and they were multiple. I mean,
that's right.
It was a show that you could not have. If anyone would have told you that this would happen the way it did, you know, they would you would be accused of writing fiction.
Right.
Or even science fiction.
Right.
But now it looks like France is up for the same type of thing, following on the heels of Brexit and, of course, the 2015 Greek vote.
Yep.
Against the European Union.
Yep.
And we now are told that Angela Merkel in Germany is in big trouble from a similar type.
Yep.
Of movement.
Yep.
And you know, even though the corporate media are calling these far-right movements, these movements are really a synthesis of multiple forces based upon the working people and what in Europe they call the precariat, this large body of unemployed young people and other people who are living on the margins of the economy, irrespective of race or national origin or even citizenship status. This new configuration politically is threatening the now almost 35-year-old neoliberal project, the what we used to identify with Reagan in the United States and Thatcher in Great Britain. I mean, this is huge, and we're at the center of it here, and the election was at the center of it. I think you and I called it right. We saw what we saw.
Yep.
And, you know, we just stayed on point. And what has happened is a real takedown of the neoliberal managerial elite that have run this thing and run the world for almost 35 years, irrespective of party label.
Yep.
I mean, my God, the so-called socialists in France.
Right.
Are part of this dirty arrangement.
Yep.
As are the Democrats and the, quote, beautiful people, you know.
Yep. Yep.
Who are now condemning with a broad brush the entire working class as backward and racist and homophobic and misogynist.
Yep.
Their behinds are now on the line, and we might be at the beginning of a new era, not just in the history of capitalism, but in world history.
Yeah.
Because the forces opposing this neoliberal elite objectively are not just the poor and working people, and in the case of this election, white working people and white poor people and the white lumpen proletariat, but their activity kind of merges with what is going on in the Philippines and Turkey and
right.
And everywhere else in the world.
Yep, Moldova.
So we're looking at a real transformation in the making.
Yep, and Moldova and Bulgaria. They had the elections also, and pro-Russian leadership was voted in each case.
Absolutely.
So, and then we had the case, I think it was the Sunday before Election Day here in the U.S., in Nicaragua, with Daniel Ortega drawing better than 70% of the vote. So much for the conservative restoration that they like to talk about in the New York Times. And, you know, a lot of forces gathering on the streets in Brazil and Argentina, where you may see working people take those countries back pretty quickly. And then, you know, just this happens in the context of all of that. And I'm really stuck on the thinking here that the only area of leverage that the Green Party has ever tried to exercise on a major stage, having renounced the power to deny Democrats the election that they were accused of in 2000 instead of claiming it, than a safe state strategy, so-called. In other words, go ahead, vote for Democrats in swing states in 2004. Then the party abandoning Cynthia McKinney in 2008. And then the Jill Stein machine comes on the scene in 2010 with Ben Mansky and David Cobb from 2004 and Medea Benjamin as of late and others. It's now the big place that they can make a splash. By the way, gee, it puts Hillary Clinton in the White House, which is exactly what the elite wants to do. And $6 million so far comes in with it.
And you know, the disingenuousness of it is that they try to hide behind, well, we're doing this because we're interested in democratic and fair elections.
So why didn't they raise $6 million during the primaries, find some Democratic and independent voters who voted for Sanders to front for them, raise $6 million to litigate that so that you could overturn the primaries in California and a slew of other states where it was clearly stolen? Why didn't they do it then?
Or why haven't they raised that kind of money to build the state-by-state Green Party, right, to put them in a position to challenge for congressional and city council, mm-hmm, and other elections building up to the 2020 election? Right. I mean, it's, you know, I think the sad thing is when we look at it in broad historical terms, Jill Stein and her group within the Green Party, which might not be the Green Party any longer, it, right, might just be her campaign.
Right.
And I think there's going to be a rebellion in the Green Party against this.
Yeah, it's already underway.
Yeah, it's underway. But, you know, what you're doing is not standing up for democracy. What you're doing is joining the camp of the war makers. And as such, as we know, war is the enemy of democracy.
That's right.
Forces that are now backing you, in fact, are celebrating Jill Stein. And only a couple of weeks ago, they were condemning her as standing in the way of a Clinton victory, and thus on the side of Trump. You know, and now they're praising her. I mean, this is, you just cannot miss what is happening here. And I'm certain that Jill and her people understand. Yeah. They have to understand.
They must understand.
And so the question is, why this betrayal? You know?
I don't know. I mean, for me, first of all, the whole idea for those people that are involved in this effort and see it as this reformist effort that's going to somehow purify elections in the United States, you know, it ignores the entire context of the entire construct. They litigated the presidential debates thing. It didn't change anything. It's the only thing that this litigation is likely to change is the outcome of this election. It's not going to do away with machines that can't be audited and proprietary software and all of that. And even if it did, you still have the existing conditions in this country, which means it's going to be rigged one way or another. I mean, what's being rigged right now is being rigged through the courts and the Electoral College and the joint session for January 6th. All of those institutions will remain after this litigation. So what are they doing?
Well, see, I think you hit on a very important point because, you know, the strategy might not be what it appears to be. I think they might know that a recount would take us beyond December 19th. That's when the Electoral College meets.
Yep.
But I think they want to create a atmosphere where politically a number of electors will nullify the election by either abstaining,
Right.
Or shifting their votes.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So let us say 20 or more electors abstain.
Right.
And let us say another 5 change their votes.
Right.
You dig what I'm saying?
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be Clinton,
possible,
by the way.
The Electoral College could then give the election on the basis of abstentions and shifting of votes to Hillary Clinton.
Yep. Or it goes to the House of Representatives, and the House could pick Clinton or, say, Biden or Warren, whoever the compromise candidate is, because so much dung has been heaped upon the outcome of the election that it's going to be widely acknowledged as having been unfair and stolen by Trump, and therefore whatever solution comes out of the process to rectify that, quote unquote, is going to be looked at as legitimate by a number of people. And that's, and so what they're doing is providing political cover for a soft coup.
Yeah, for a soft coup, which would include a kind of movement towards impeachment, you know, that reminds us of what's going on in Brazil.
That's right.
And, you know, it's so interesting, those who have made careers off of stealing elections, in particular the Clinton machine, are now claiming to be the victims of a stolen election.
Right.
You know, so, you know, the ironies are just abundant. They abound. And I am certain without a real effort to politically educate the people, the masses of people will be in a state of bewilderment,
yep,
not understanding what is happening. And of course, that creates a dangerous situation. And I'm thinking, especially given the tense situation in the world, for example, between the United States and Russia,
yeah,
or the United States and China, or in Syria. So it's a very, very dangerous situation, because there is, even though we talk about President Trump, President-elect Trump, there is really a vacuum of leadership at the executive level. And whether Trump is sworn in or not, he will find it more difficult to govern than even Obama did. I mean, his presidency is being deemed illegitimate, not just by Democrats, but by a broad swath of political forces now, which includes the left.
Yep. You've got a number of well, first of all, let's play that out. You have a situation where, you know, NATO, the U.S. is deployed basically to the borders of Russia and China with weapon systems hot and new ones coming in. And Russia seeing first the election and understanding it and reporting it and, you know, reaching out to Trump saying, okay, cool, you said we want to be friends, let's be friends. And Trump saying, yeah, let's be friends. And all of a sudden, maybe it doesn't look like it to the American people, but the Russians can see in reality when a coup d'etat happens. And they know who the forces are that are managing it, even if Americans don't. And they realize that it may well mean war is coming to them any minute. So now when they look at reflections off the ground or, you know, some moonbeam behind a cloud or whatever and see it through their defense systems, who knows if they push a button because they figure here it comes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're mourning the death of Comandante Fidel Castro at this moment, but we must be reminded now of the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close we came,
yep,
to nuclear war. And the weapons we have now are far larger and far more destructive and reach their targets much quicker than in 1962. I mean, we're in dangerous water. And, you know, Don, you and I have talked about this over the months, that the issue the principal issue in this election is war and peace. I spoke, I think the weekend, yes, the Saturday before the election, here in Philadelphia at a rally, a Green Party rally, alongside of Chris Hedges, Jill Stein, Ajamu Baraka, and other local leaders. And, you know, I said there pretty much what we have been saying over the months, that the issue, the overriding issue, is the question of war and peace. And that Trump had made it absolutely clear over and over and over again that he was not interested in war, that he wanted detente, that he saw the enemy as ISIL and the Al-Nusra Front and those type of gangster forces, that he would unite with Russia and by implication, the Assad government, that the world was better with Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein, that he was against nation building and intervention in nations. What he was objectively saying, that he wanted to get back on the side of international law and bring the United States out of the realm of being a rogue pro-terrorist regime. We saw it that way. I spoke that way, you know, alongside of Jill Stein. And I invoked the words of W.E.B. Du Bois, who was indicted because of his anti-nuclear weapons position and activism in 1951. And there he said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called communists." Is that condemnation for the peacemaker or praise for the communist? I mean, you know, that in that, in those beautiful, eloquent words, and I applied them to Jill and Ajamu. Blessed are Jill and Ajamu, you know, and I spoke from my heart, and I said to Jill, you know, after I finished, she was sitting beside me, and I said, I meant every word of it, Jill, and she was very moved by what I had to say, and it seemed that we were on the same page. You know, I feel personally betrayed by this turn that she has made. I don't know how to explain it. It doesn't make sense. I mean, and there are a lot of things in this year that had not made a lot of sense.
Well, right in this, as a matter of fact.
The most recent one.
Right in this, as a matter of fact, because, you know, when I first saw it, I think yesterday morning, whenever it was, that they had actually filed, I went off the deep a little bit, and I posted something at Facebook. I assumed it was the Green Party, because the way it was presented was that was a natural assumption. And as it turns out, they took this project to the Green National Committee, or one of the executive committees of the party, and it was voted down. And the majority of the leadership said, we don't want anything to do with this. This is going to elect Clinton. That's the point of it, and it's going to tarnish us. Mm-hmm. And yet, they went out with it. They announced it, okay, as the green logo was on it, and it was Stein Baraka. And then I saw on Facebook that someone said that the Ajamu Baraka wasn't consulted and, you know, wasn't with it. So, you know, it seems like for the candidate of a party that relies on grassroots democracy, not only was I, as a green registrant, not consulted on it, or apparently nor was anyone else, but when they consulted the leadership of the party, who, you know, represent the rest of us in one way or another, they said no. And yet they went ahead with it anyway, and they raised, you know, they're raising all this money and you know, making this big stink. They're all over CNN and New York Times and everywhere else, and lending legitimacy to the coup that is clearly underway.
That's right. That's right. And it's a coup not in behalf of democracy. It's the opposite.
Right. That's right.
And, you know, of course, the corporate media is playing a huge role. You know, the left, and we've, you know, over these months, Don, we've been very critical of the left, what goes for the left. And I think it's now very apparent that the left is being organized by the liberals and being mobilized by the liberals.
Yep.
I don't care whether it was the pop-up demonstrations after the elections or the marches that will occur going forward. You know, the Million Women's March or the Million March of Women, the march or at the inauguration to shut down the inauguration. It appears to me that, and this is not unusual in human, modern human history, that the left becomes a tail to the liberals, and the liberals operating through non-governmental organizations and foundations and other vehicles are making it possible and encouraging the activity of, and you know, you really do have to put quotes around the word, the left.
Right.
This is a sad day.
Yeah. Let me just ask you something. I want to ask you something on this point. No. I want to ask you something on this point. Because we're getting close to the end, and I want to get an answer to this for everyone, myself included. If you look through this, and let's say that they suddenly Trump isn't the president on January 20th, there's, you know, whatever, 47-48% of the electorate and a quarter of the population or 20-30% of population, whatever, that is going to be very angry. And they're going to go into the streets and it's going to be genuine. It's not going to be, AstroTurf grassroots activity. And the possibility exists of an intra-class war, basically, of a civil war being started. And those people, of course, are going to be painted as racist and, you know, Nazis and all of that. And coming through that, if we end up with an actual civil war or just so much unrest that there's a government crackdown, what does this left that thinks it's the left that's going to get through this have in terms of organization, in terms of the ability to govern, the mechanical, you know, wherewithal to govern, a program? They don't even have that, and class unity. Absent those things, this can only turn out to a repressive, overtly fascistic government to maintain order. Are they thinking it through to that far?
Well, obviously not. And, you know, when you listen to the ways that they talk and the concepts that they throw around, and especially they're attributing all things that are wrong with the politics of the country, they attribute that to the white working class and by implication, working people in general. They think, and these are, you know, some very sophisticated scholars make this point that it was a white lash.
Right.
That's pure and simple. No other explanation, no other information is necessary. And a white lash that is the fault of the white poor and working class. You know, it appears to me that for the first time in decades, a majority of white working people voted more or less for their class interests.
Yep.
You know, there had been a discourse going back to the 1980s. Thomas Frank wrote the book, What Happened in Kansas. And what he argued is that with the election of Reagan, the working class, the white working class, was set on a path of voting against its class interests. You know, I wouldn't argue with that. Of course, there was no serious leadership to define what their class interest was.
And there was no alternative offered. I mean, Carter wasn't offering them a solution either.
That's right. No question. So now they vote closer to their class interest. And by that, I mean, vote for a candidate that's against war and against the neoliberal architecture of trade and so on and so forth. Right. They voted closer to their class interests than they have in decades.
Right.
But the game is not over because of one election. It is what happens going forward.
That's
how
right.
the working class and the working people and the poor come together in this new moment of challenge. And this is what is before us. The left, what we call the left, which is really a group of small organizations that proceed from an infantile and childish understanding of revolutionary processes. They really are not. They can't play a role in this. They're mainly middle class and petty bourgeoisie, and you know they talk a lot, but on the ground they're very ineffective. If we go to what you're suggesting, most of what we call the left will run for the hills because they don't know how to handle this kind of situation.
Professor Montero, thank you very much for that.
Thank you, Don.
You've been listening to CPR Sunday. I'm Don DeBar, your host. I look forward to seeing you again next week.